We'll call the tax committee to order. Members, thank you for your willingness to come in on a Friday and get an overview from finance and our state economist on the current budget forecast. And it's going to have an impact on the work this committee does over the balance of the session and certainly the other finance committees in the Senate. So, Commissioner Hansen, Dr. Stinson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. As we have in the past, we have a three-part presentation. I will provide some overview comments and talk about the numbers generally. Our state economist, Dr. Stinson, will talk about the economy, the national economy, the state economy, and its impact on our anticipated revenues. And Jim Showalter, our state budget director, will talk about what is happening with our expenditures. We have provided, I understand you have the full booklet in your packets, as well as the executive summary, and then we have the slide presentation as well. And we'll be referencing the slide during our presentation. If you look at the first slide, as we all saw yesterday, the combined revenue expenditure and reserve changes leave us with a $935 million deficit. This is $562 million more than what we had forecast in November. So if you look at the second slide, what are the main underpinnings of this forecast? The first main point is that the story of this forecast continues to be the worsening national economy and its impact on our state's anticipated revenues and expenditures. Our macroeconomic consultant, Global Insights, has forecast a recession for the first two quarters of 2008 and then a bounce up in the third and fourth quarter of this year due to the federal stimulus package, which became law last month. It is with this stimulus that has made in the forecast a short, mild recession. The general fund revenues for 2008-2009 are now forecast to total $32.5 billion. That's $530 million less than in November, and even more significantly, $1.27 billion less than the end of last session. The drop in revenue continues to be a significant drop in corporate income tax. You will see when Dr. Stinson talks that we are down almost 21% from last February. The other difference, the other big drop in this forecast is the individual income tax. If you remember, Mr. Chairman, that in the November forecast, we actually had more in individual income tax collections than we had forecast in February. The general fund spending in this for this biennium is for the most part on target. Minor changes. We are up $64 million from November's estimate and $130 from last session. And 33 of the 64 is due to a human services payment that was categorized as a reserve right after session and became a payment to counties in December. And then the last point on my slide before I turn it over to Dr. Stinson, the longer-term outlook for the state has changed significantly since last session. When the 2008-2009 budget was enacted, we had a positive balance of $1.137 billion. That was enough to cover what Global Insights at the time was forecasting for inflation. This forecast now shows a shortfall of $1.086 billion. When you add in the CPI inflation factor of 1.9%, that is in the Global Insights report, you add another 1.04 for about a total of 2.1 and some change.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pogba.
Commissioner, just quick before we get too deep into this, I was a little surprised by the governor's comment yesterday that we had a spending problem, not a revenue problem. And I'm kind of looking at this chart, and it appears that revenue is the problem, not spending at this moment. How do you see that?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman.
You see the chart I'm looking at here? The second slide, or the first slide, I guess. Seems like revenue's $530 million down for 08-09. Spending's just up a little, $64 million.
Senator Pogermiller, one way to look at it, from the governor's perspective, the revenues have not kept up. We haven't kept up with expenditures, and we should, you know the line, Minnesotans are taxed enough, and we should control expenditures before we seek to increase revenues.
But
it's a matter of perspective.
But it is true that revenues have not kept up with expenditures.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogermiller, expenditures have grown. We enacted a budget last year of expenditures that didn't keep up with our...
Well, Commissioner, would it be fair to say that revenues not coming in at the rate we had forecasted it to?
Yes.
That something has happened so that the revenue we thought we were going to have a year ago, we don't have today?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogermiller, yes. That's clear.
Senator Pogermiller.
But does this chart not say that based on last year's budget, it's the drop in revenues?
You're looking at You're looking at the chart that Dr. Stinson is going to get to in a minute.
Are you looking at the first page? Okay, the first.
This one, yes.
Now what?
Revenues are down when we set our budget. Revenues are down $530 million, and this just for 08-09. And spending is up only 64. So based on what we were doing last year and the projections in the governor's budget, it just seems so obvious that revenues are down. That's the issue.
Revenues are down.
Okay. Thank you.
Commissioner, continue.
I think with that, unless Senator Pogermiller wants to talk about inflation or anything, I'll turn it over to Dr. Stinson.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you. Before you do that, Commissioner, I had a question for you. I think it's on that second slide, and I'm wondering if that was inclusive of your comments, because at the end it talks about the $1.1 billion shortfall expected for 2010-2011. And if you were not intended to, or if others were not, could you explain how you get to that $1.1 billion for 2010 and 11?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, the $1.1 billion shortfall is our planning estimates for 2010-2011. We look ahead to try to anticipate the revenue collections that we're going to have. And then statutorily, we are not allowed to factor in inflation. The Finance Department has a policy of mentioning it in our budget forecast so that we're at least aware of it. And the 1.1 is almost a complete mirror reversal. We were 1.1 up to 1.1 down, so it does reflect a significant reduction in revenue that we thought we were going to be receiving that we didn't. We built a 2008-2009 biennial budget on revenues that weren't there.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, it's a straight line projection, if you will, so it doesn't include inflation, but does it include factoring any of the trends? Or it's just, if these are our revenues now, then, and we assume that they will be the same, collected at the same rate, or are there some assumptions built into that or some trends included, is my question.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman.
Dr. Stinson.
The calculation of the planning estimate revenue is a little more complicated than you're describing here. Okay, we begin with the Global Insight forecast for the national economy, for national economic growth, and we assume that Minnesota is going to grow at the same rate as the national economy. And that's not the same inflation-adjusted rate. That's the same rate including inflation. So inflation is built into the revenue figures, and we say that Minnesota is going to grow at the same rate as the national economy. Now, you're being on the tax committee, you're familiar with the HITS model that is used to produce estimates of the income tax receipts. What we do is we take this one single national growth factor for taxable income and apply it to all of the pieces of income, all of the sources of income that go into the HITS model. So wages, interest, dividends, capital gains, farm income, everything grows at the same rate as U.S. national income, and we run the HITS model that way. Now, that produces an answer. It's not necessarily going to be an accurate answer because we know things are going to be different in 2010, 2011 for interest and dividends and all these kinds of things. But it's kind of a combination of – it's kind of a sophisticated pencil and ruler approach in here. The one thing that we've done differently for the 2010-2011 planning estimates that we don't usually do is because there's a change in federal law regarding the tax federal taxation of capital gains, and the federal tax rate on capital gains increases between 2010 and 2011. We know that if that law is not changed, that people are smart enough to say, wait a minute, why should I sell my stock in January when I can pay 5% less tax if I sell it in December? And so we expect tax year 2010 to have a reasonably big surge in capital gains realizations, which will show up in tax year 2011, in fiscal year 2011, in the final payments in fiscal year 2011. And then we expect in tax year 2011, the snapback or the payback for that acceleration comes. And so there's about a $320 million acceleration of income into fiscal year 2011. That distorts it. It adds $320 million that wouldn't normally be there. But then fiscal year 2012, which we don't report in this forecast, but we will next November, ends up to be about $320 million short. And so there's a $640 million cliff because you add 320 here and you take away 320 there. And so that's the one difference in this forecast compared to otherwise.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, a quick follow-up. if the Minnesota economy is not growing as fast or at the same pace as the U.S. economy, this number is short for our 2010, 2011. And the fact is that Minnesota's economy is not working at the same pace as the federal economy.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, that's right. Of course, if Minnesota's economy grows faster than the U.S. economy, and historically we have grown faster than the U.S. economy, then this is going to be an understatement of the revenues that we have. And our assumption is the best thing to do is to say we're going to grow at the U.S. economic rate. Our crystal ball is a little cloudy looking 4 and 5 years out into the future.
Okay, thank you. That was very helpful.
So Dr. Stinson, if Congress were to make permanent the, I guess they're commonly referred to as the Bush tax cuts, if Congress were to make them permanent, would our deficit for 10 and 11 grow by something in the neighborhood of $300 million then, we expect?
Mr. Chairman, that's right.
Commissioner, the does the 935 contemplate any debt service for a potential bonding bill that the legislature might pass this year? And does it contemplate anything in the form of victims relief from the I-35 bridge disaster? Or if I see the House passed, it's anticipated to be a $40 million package last night. I'm assuming we're going to do something with a bonding bill with $20 to $30 million of additional debt service. Do those add on to the 935, or is there some money built in here for those two scenarios?
Mr. Chairman, we build in for the bonding bill debt service up to $645 million, and that's the 10-year average of the large year bonding bills. So any interest above and beyond that 645 we have to provide general fund cash for. And then the compensation fund for the victims of the I-35 bridge would be not be included in this forecast, but would be considered a new initiative, both of which we will account for in our budget next week.
And then in 10 and 11, I was talking with Senator Cohen about the transportation bill that was just enacted. The sales tax on leased vehicles, is no longer going to flow into the general fund. And I believe Senator Cohen told me that in the 10-11 biennium, there was no cost in the current biennium, but in 10 and 11, the cost of that is, I think he said $113 million in 10 and 11. Do we know what that number is? And does that then, is the transportation bill factored into this forecast, or does that leased vehicle make the 10 and 11 number worse? Maybe Mr. Showalter.
Mr. Chair, the transportation bill figures are not figured into the numbers before you. We will be re-estimating the impact of the bill based upon the economic assumptions. So, for instance, on leased vehicle, that would make the 10 and 11 numbers a little worse. There are other factors in that that at the time of enactment estimated cost of about $77 million in 10 and 11. So assuming no economic impact on those numbers, you'd at least add $77 million to the problem in 2010 and 11.
Thank you. That's helpful. Commissioner, are we turning it over to Dr. Stinson, or where are we at in the
Turn it over to Dr.
program?
Stinson.
Dr. Stinson, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your third slide, I think, shows the change in revenues from the November forecast. And you can see that the two largest sources of decline from November were 313, about 2% in the individual income tax, and about $139 million, 7% in the corporate income tax. But that's a little misleading just to look at the change from November. Really what we have is we have a change from the outlook last February adjusted for session activity. And your fourth slide shows a better example, gives us a better example of what's happened to revenues in this forecast compared to the forecast on which the budget was established. And here you can see that the individual income tax is down 1.8%, about $282 million. The sales tax is down 322%, $322 million, about 3.4%. The corporate tax is down $456 million, or 21%. Other revenues down $200 million. In total, we have a decline of $1.27 billion in revenues, or 3.8%. Now, to Senator Pogemiller's point, there is growth in this forecast in revenues. The growth is 0.6% over the prior biennium. So we haven't gotten to the point where we're actually below revenues that we collected in there, but it's much slower growth than we had projected at the time. Looking at each one of the individual taxes, there's kind of an interesting story to a tax person on each one of the individual taxes. The first is the individual income tax. Here, even though we have a recession in the forecast, it's a relatively mild recession, and it doesn't have the kind of impact on wages that you might expect. Of the $282 million, only about a quarter of that drop is because of lower-than-expected wages. The remainder is because of lower-than-expected non-wage income, particularly portfolio income. Now, we recognize that the farm sector is doing a lot better than normal. It's just a very good time to have wheat in the bins that hasn't been forward contracted, for example, at this point. But even with the additional income for the farm sector, we have a drop here of roughly $210 million. The sources of that drop, the big sources are three. Capital gains is the first big source. That accounts for more than half of the drop, and then interest income and dividend income account for the rest. The capital gains issue is an issue that is always a problem when we do a revenue forecast, because we really don't know what's going to happen to the stock market and what's going to happen to people's decisions to sell stock. You know, do you let your gains ride for the next year, or do you sell it in the current year? And it's a big, volatile source of revenue. When recessions occur, we know that two sources of capital gains often dry up and dry up almost completely. One is the sale of businesses. If I sell my hardware store, if I sell my physician's practice to someone else, that tends to dry up in a recession. And then the other is sales of commercial property. And so when it's almost like there's a switch that's flipped, and it's recession, no recession. Once there's talk about recession, that begins to dry up. Once the recession talk goes away, that begins to come back again. We didn't have a drop in capital gains because of that switch occurring in the November forecast. In February, we felt that it was appropriate to do that, and so we brought our capital gains estimates down. Now, we didn't bring them down an enormous amount. We brought them for 2008, the capital gains growth was brought down from 10% to a 5% decline. 5% decline may seem like a lot, but in 2001, capital gains actually fell by 45%, and in 2002, the year after the recession, it fell by an additional 22%. So this is possibly a conservative estimate of how much capital gains is going to drop. On the other hand, the stock market was a lot more overvalued in 2000 and 2001 than it is today, and so there was a lot farther to drop from. That explains the largest portion of the individual income taxes, the capital gains drop, the interest drop, and the dividends drop. The sales tax, we were down $309 million in the November forecast, and we only added an additional $13 million of decline to that in this forecast. That occurs for two reasons. First, there was a change in the estimate of sales tax refunds. Sales tax refunds were decreased by $35 million, and so that adds to the sales tax base that you would have, or to the net. The second is that the federal stimulus package comes in and actually boosts consumer non-auto durable spending above the November forecast in the third and fourth quarters of 2008. And so the combination of the boost to consumer durable spending and the $35 million change in sales tax refunds ends up keeping the change in sales tax refunds or sales tax growth to be very small. The third story is the corporate income tax. Here we're down 21% from last year. We weren't optimistic about the outlook for the forecast. In fact, if you remember, we told you that we didn't believe the Global Insight forecast, and we were doing things to hold down the growth that was projected in corporate income tax or in corporate income. Turns out that we were not pessimistic enough, and so we're down 20%. We're down 20% from the actual amount collected in 2006-2007. There are two reasons for this, actually two big reasons for it. First, corporate profits are less, taxable corporate profits are less than were expected. Our estimated tax payments were not keeping pace with the forecast for estimated tax payments. We adjusted them down, redid our model, and we have had a little better success since the November forecast. The second thing that's happened is that corporations apparently believe that on a taxable basis, at least, earnings for 2007 or 2000 for 2007 or 2008 are not going to be as strong as had been previously expected, and they're taking larger amounts of refunds than they have historically. Between the middle of January and the middle of February, we paid out over $50 million in refunds. That was substantially more than we had in the forecast, or more than we would have historically. That money's out the door, and so that's obviously been counted as well. So the bottom line, again, is that we're down $1.27 billion, about 3.8% since the prior forecast. That's toward the high end of the normal range, but we normally have, you know, our goal is to try and be within 5%, and so this still is within 5% in there. It gives you some idea of the amount of volatility that exists in the tax system.
Dr. Stinson, are there things we could do to make the tax system less volatile?
Mr. Chairman, yes, there are. One thing that you could do to make the tax system less volatile is make it less dependent on the corporate income tax. The corporate income tax is incredibly volatile, and to the extent that you reduce dependence on the corporate income tax, you reduce the volatility of the system. Now, as you know, there are other goals for the tax system besides volatility, and people believe that you know, a tax system should be efficient, meaning it shouldn't distort decisions. Corporate income tax doesn't really show up very well on that. It should be equitable, should be fair. A lot of people believe that the corporate income tax is fair. A lot of people don't believe that it's fair, but if you shift that revenue somewhere else, the question is, where would it be fair to shift it to? And so that's a problem. One thing that would reduce the volatility of the tax system but wouldn't necessarily be generally approved is, instead of having a corporate income tax, you could have a property tax, a revenue neutral shift, have a property tax on corporate property. Now, that creates a whole other set of difficulties, but it would reduce the volatility of the tax. Another place where you could reduce the volatility of the tax is in the capital gains area. Capital gains is a source of income that is large and grows faster, but also can decline very much faster than the income tax base. By changing the proportion of capital gains realizations that are treated as taxable income, in the way, for example, Wisconsin does, where there's only a portion of capital gains brought in there, that would reduce the volatility of the tax base, but you'd have to make up the income in some way. One of the ways you could do it possibly is by raising the tax rate on the highest income class, the people that would be most benefiting from that exemption in part of the capital gains. I mean, there are ways that you can do this, but there's always a question of fairness then, and there's always a question of what happens to economic incentives if you make this change in the tax system. And so, but there are ways that you can do that.
So, Dr. Stinson, is there less variability in the higher income wage earners' income tax liability than in the lower end? I mean, are their incomes and their tax liabilities more stable in the upper income ranges than in the lower income ranges?
Um, We don't have good panel information where we're tracking the same individual each year for over a period of years. But at the very high end, the upper half a percent or 1%, I suspect that there is a lot of variability because a lot of this is one-time capital gains where you make $10 million of selling some property or selling your business, and the next year you're back down to more normal income. There are the professional athletes that make $1 million or $2 million, or the entertainers that make huge amounts that have consistent earnings over time at the top end. But aside from high-level CEOs and even high-level CEOs who exercise options or don't, they may move in or out of that very top group in there.
Thank you. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Stinson, when you talk of capital gain, I don't think the state has a technical capital gain treatment similar to the federal government here in this state. We don't reduce our taxable gain down to a smaller amount to encourage a capital gain sale. So when we have a capital, it doesn't mean that there aren't capital gain sales. It just means that we tax them, is it correct, as ordinary or as income? And is it a corporate income or is it an individual? I would imagine it's either or because of whoever owns that asset that they sell. Is that correct?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, I didn't mean to indicate that that I believe that the old style of treatment of capital gains and under the federal tax law was there. Both Minnesota and the U.S. count 100% of capital gains as taxable or ordinary income coming in. The federal government, however, has a special tax rate for that particular type of income, mm-hmm. and it's limited to at this point 15%. It will go to 20% if the tax law isn't changed. Wisconsin has an exemption, as you probably know. You can take some of the capital gains income out of there that way. By taxing it at a lower rate, you would also reduce the volatility.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair and Dr. Stinson, I don't know if the state has this capability, but is there an opportunity in the state at least to capture that taxable income, but instead of having these spikes every year or not? Like you said, someone might experience a capital gain sale. They have a big chunk of money to pay into the coffers of the state in 1 year, and then from a state perspective, there's no income left after that one sale for years to come. Do we have any type of income averaging where state tax policy would allow someone to spread that gain over a number of years, 3 to 5 years, and then have it taxed that way? If that was possible, would that at least, we still would get the income coming in, but it would be spread out over a wider period of time. Would that lessen the volatility of that cash revenue flow?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, my understanding is that we have no income averaging at this point.
Right.
Okay. In terms of limiting the volatility, it would take some of the, it might be useful if you turn to what must be about page 12 of your packet of the Xerox. There's a graph of capital gains. It's maybe three in from the back. That's the one, yes. What averaging would do would be it would chop off those big spikes, but it wouldn't do very much for that big drop, that 45% drop in 2001 or the 22% drop in 2002. So it would take some of the upside volatility off, but once people decide they're not going to sell capital assets, the flow through from the prior year is probably not going to make that much difference. I mean, it would help in a technical sense where you're calculating the standard deviation of the income in there. That would help, but it wouldn't necessarily stop that downside loss in there.
Well, Mr. Chair and Dr. Stinson, it may not reduce that downward spike, but how often do we have that large of a downward spike anyway? Is that something that's rather predictable every 3 to 4 or 5 years, or is that kind of an anomaly?
Mr. Chairman, unfortunately, that kind of a downward spike occurs every time we have a recession. If you look back 1990-91, you can see we had 3 down years there. The second year, almost 20%. In 1994, the Republicans took control of Congress in the November elections, and it was widely anticipated that there would be a reduction in the capital gains tax rate. We only had November and December for it to be reflected in market activity, but if you look, you can see that on this graph in 1994, there was no growth in capital gains because of people delaying their realizations of capital gains until after the first of the year in hope of getting more favorable tax treatment. So,
Mr. Chair, Dr. Stinson, did that reduction capital gains treatment ever occur? Were the Republicans successful in ever reducing it?
It didn't occur in that year. It did occur, but it didn't occur in that year. This was just anticipation.
Some of the more fiscal hawks of that time have looked at Congress during the time of Republican majority, and they didn't do a whole lot in controlling their spending either. And they were busy looking for more cash flow to send bucks back home. And I think that might have had a little bit to do with the explanation of why that was so delayed, and brought a lot of criticism on part of fiscal hawks that they had their opportunity and they didn't take advantage of it.
Mr. Chairman, I want to return back to where I was in the presentation and go through.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's a good segue. Just real quick.
Senator, I was hoping you weren't going to take the bait.
No, I'm not. But just I think Senator Limmer has made a good point there. And I just wanted, I've received some data on spending at the state level general fund. And all I want to do is pass this out and then just ask finance if they would verify this data, but update it to the February forecast. This data was premised on November forecast. And if you just take a look at the chart and have your people verify this for the February forecast with whatever information you'd like me to know about the general fund spending. This indicates that general fund spending has gone down dramatically during the last 4 or 5 years. And so, Mr. Chairman, I don't want us. All I want to do is get the information from the department. And it was a segue that Senator Limmer allowed. Whether the national government reduced spending or not, I think Senator Limmer is probably right. But I think we have data here that indicates that in the last 3 or 4 years, there has been a dramatic decrease in real spending in Minnesota. And so I'll just leave it at that, Commissioner. Don't want to go further now, but if your folks would look at it. And this was done. You can see who this is done by. So if you need information, feel free to talk with Mr. Van Wyken. He's in the audience at some point. So. I'm just looking for verification of whether this is accurate information, but updated to February forecast. Okay?
Commissioner,
thank you.
Can you get that for the committee?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogermiller, I'm sure we can.
Great. Thank you very much.
A little truth test on the author of this chart. Senator Limmer?
Mr. Chair, far be it from me to ever try and bring a question up that might bait someone into a response.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, that just brings me to the inflation-adjusted forecast then? I mean, if you're going to look at the inflation-adjusted spending, you could look at the adjusted inflation-adjusted forecast.
Absolutely.
And if I'm reading this right, you have to add $1.04 billion to the $1.1 billion that you're projecting. Did I read that right? That if you're going to adjust for inflation, then the deficit for 2010-11 is more like $2.2 billion.
Mr.
Commissioner?
Chairman, Senator Ehrman, yes. I'm still...
Thank you.
Senator Pogermiller's chart, trying to figure it out. So maybe
For later. I didn't mean to interrupt, but Senator...
Like waving a toy in front of somebody, I get to say.
We don't get going, members. We're going to keep Dr. Stinson and myself from lunch. So, Dr. Stinson, please continue.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'll speed up here. The bottom line on the reason for the revenue declines is that we're in a recession. There's a graph, it's probably on page 6 of your handout, full-page handout, that shows the path that Global Insight expects for the economy. If you look at 2008, the two bars are show an actual decline of 0.4% and 0.5%. This is a classic recession, two quarters of negative GDP growth. The important thing and the thing that you need to be concerned about, I think, is that the stimulus package bounces us out of that decline in the third quarter and the fourth quarter of 2008, but the stimulus from the stimulus package runs out in the first quarter of 2009, and we're back down to growth of only 0.7%. Now, that's still growth, but that's not growth at the rate that we would normally expect to see the economy moving at. One of our concerns is that underlying this forecast is an assumption that oil prices drop to $80 a barrel this quarter, $75 a barrel in the next three quarters. If that doesn't occur, it's not the end of the world. It doesn't automatically plunge us deep into a recession, but it does knock 2 or 3 tenths of a percent off the growth rate for each $10 per barrel that we under that oil prices are over the estimate. So say we're at $100 a barrel rather than $75 a barrel, what that means is that 0.7% growth rate could suddenly be 6, 7, 8%, 0.8% less. So that could easily be negative in the first quarter of 2009. We'd be back into a recession that could then flow forward into the end of the biennium. So there is downside risk for the economy here, and it's something that you need to be aware of as you're making your budget plans. Here, you know, the implications are that the reserve is a very important risk management tool that will help us manage both the risk from different capital gains realizations than we thought and this possible double-dip recession that's at least potentially there given the oil price assumption rate.
So, Dr. Stinson, are you saying that the recession that we're in the first two quarters of 2008 we artificially pop out of because of the federal stimulus package and then we potentially slip back in?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Now, you know, we're not officially in a recession yet, but it'll take probably another 4 or 5 months before the National Bureau of Economic Research compiles enough data to say whether we went into a recession in January or December or February or whenever it is. It certainly looks very much like it at this point, but data can always be revised, and they're much more academic, I guess maybe is the right way of putting it, in their approach. They don't have to worry about doing anything for the economy or anything like that. It's just making an appropriate call here. They're not in a prospective action mode or anything.
About half of the forecasters.
Yeah.
Predicting
yeah. At least half of the forecasters. Most of the forecasters actually that we follow closely have a recession in their forecast. If you look in the complete book that you have a copy of, on page 54. You can see how our forecasting service, Global Insight forecast, compares to other major forecasters. They have, as I've told you, a 0.4% decline and a 0.5% decline. Moody's Economy.com, Mark Zandi's forecast is for 0.3% decline and 0.3% decline. Maury Harris at UBS, -1%, -1.5%. David Weiss at Standard & Poor's, 0.7% for both quarters. The blue chip forecast that's the second one up there is the composite of 50 forecasters. And the problem with that is it was not taken at the same time. It's taken a little bit earlier, and it was actually taken before the January employment numbers came out. Which showed that employment in the national economy declined by 17,000. And so it's not quite at the same time as other people delivered their forecasts. So that's the reason why it's there. The one notable outlier is Dan Laufenberg, a local forecaster who works for Ameriprise, who is very much out on a limb in terms of his forecast for the U.S. economy. The thing that you need to know is that in Dan's world, the U.S. economy does well until the end of the year, and then we go into a recession in 2009. So he just has a bigger recession delayed for 2009. So Dan's not what you would call totally optimistic or anything like that.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. Stinson. As I look at the Global Insight chart, I see that it drops in the first quarter, but it looks like there's another uptick in the second quarter. What precipitates that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Larson, the Federal Reserve has been lowering interest rates and lowering interest rates and lowering interest rates, and we know that monetary policy can stimulate the economy, but it takes a while. It takes somewhere between 12 and 18 months for it to have an impact. And that is the monetary policy stimulus that we've seen, particularly the big changes that occurred in January. That's roughly a year plus after those were put into place. Eventually beginning to have an impact and encourage business spending.
Just a brief follow-up, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Stinson, how long does the monetary policy changes that have occurred trend out for beyond that? I know it's difficult to forecast that, but what is our experience with how long that benefit occurs?
I think what you're asking is what happens to the Fed funds rate? When does it start to come back up again? And the Fed funds rate drops to 2% from the 3.25% that it's at right now. It drops another 125 basis points. By the end of the spring. It stays at 2% until the first quarter of 2009, and then it goes up to 2.5%, and then 3%, and then 3.5% in the next three quarters. Now, what you may be alluding to is some concern that Chairman Bernanke expressed in the last 2 days about the possible increase in inflation, that inflation may be a challenge for the Fed to deal with, as well as growth rates. And the question is, given that you have two demands on the Fed, three demands on the Fed. One is to make sure that the banking system has enough liquidity to operate, two, to stimulate the economy, and three, to keep inflation under control. And you only have one switch that you can push, or one lever that you can push one way or the other. And keeping inflation under control requires tightening monetary policy, but stimulating the economy and keeping the banking system working requires lower interest rates and increased liquidity. You know, what happens here? And the global insight assumption, and really the optimistic assumption, the assumption that most economists make, is that the Fed is going to be successful in both pushing a while and then finding the right time to start slowing the economy down again to keep inflation from getting out of control. If the combination of lower value of the dollar and increasing prices for commodities and things like that work through the system and create inflation, the Fed may, you know, at the end of next summer, be faced with a real difficult task of, do you keep pushing on the economy or do you start slowing the economy because of inflation? If the Fed starts slowing the economy for inflation, it's one of these things where it's not symmetric, that the Fed can slow the economy a lot more quickly than it can start the economy. And so you could have the Fed's tightening beginning to impact again the first quarter of 2009 as well. Now, that's not what's in this forecast, but if the Fed were to start tightening the end of next summer, that other things equal, that would probably push economic growth down closer to zero or maybe below zero in the first quarter as well. So your point's a very good one, that this concern about inflation that appears to be emerging isn't reflected in the forecast.
Dr. Stinson, can economic forecasters can economic forecasters, with any degree of reliability, predict what the Fed is going to do with monetary policy? And there must be some history under Greenspan. He was there long enough. Were economic forecasters, was there any reliability in anticipating what he was going to do?
Mr. Chairman, it depends upon how long, how far in the future you're talking about. People know pretty well what the Fed's going to do at the next meeting or the next couple of meetings, given the information that they have. They can do that. But in terms of what's going to happen next October, nobody knows. You know, if you knew what inflation was going to be over the summer, and if you knew what economic growth was going to be over the summer, you'd have a good idea. But since we're not very good at predicting economic growth or inflation either, we're particularly bad about forecasting behavior that's based on actual economic growth and inflation.
Senator Hartman.
That was I tried to follow that. I did my best. My question is about the economic stimulus package. There's an assumption here that the stimulus package will increase, and the chart says, household spending on non-automotive consumer durables, and that stimulus will slow the recession and actually make it a mild recession as opposed to a full-blown recession, in theory. And then there are all kinds of assumptions that follow from that, that the economic stimulus will work. It means, you know, the assumption then is that the housing permits will recover, and you can see that in the chart that follows, and that the capital gains realizations will drop then, but then increase. And I'm wondering, is there any experience or history to suggest that this economic stimulus will do what it's intended to do? Because I'm concerned that while we're sending the money out from the federal government, there's no reason to believe that Minnesotans will actually spend that money in the way that it's anticipated because of other burdens, financial burdens, debt, because of new taxes, whatever, that they might not actually spend that money on those non-auto consumer durables. And I wonder how, if you can comment about whether that's a real possibility, or we have some experience in history to say, no, this is what's going to happen with the stimulus package.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, we do have some experience in history as to what happens with the stimulus package. There are really three large-scale econometric studies that have been done, and the bottom line, without getting into a lot of detail, is that in one of them, they interviewed people, asked them what they would do with the money, what they said they were going to do with the money, and about 20% said they'd spend it, and the other 80% said they wouldn't spend it, that they'd save it. Later, another group, actually two other groups, have gone back and looked at the actual data and tried to say what happened to spending on these various areas compared to what you would think would have happened without the stimulus package. And they found that a little bit more than 20% spent the money in the next 3 months or so and the rest saved it, but then it metered out over time. The general belief now is that about 20%, well, the assumption in this forecast is that about 20% of the stimulus package will be spent in the first 3 months. Another 20% will be spent by individuals in the next 3 months. They'll either put it in the bank or use it to buy down their credit card balance, but then around Christmas they'll drive their credit card balance back up to where it had been before, basically, is what's in there. So that's the assumption in there. In Minnesota, with the sales tax rebate checks, it's hard to tell what happened, but if you look real carefully at the data and you believe that we were good forecasters, then what you see is that by October, we started to see a little bounce in sales tax receipts, and that little bounce in sales tax receipts stayed in November, then kind of disappeared into the muddle of Christmas, but we actually saw a little bit there. Now, this isn't a lot of money in change, but it makes a big difference when it's all concentrated in 3 months. So nationally, $107 billion is going to be rebated to consumers. That's about 3.2% of GDP if you dump it all in one quarter. And so that's noticeable, and that's how we get that bounce up in the forecast that you've seen.
Dr. Stinson, that 20% that you referenced from previous studies, what the 20% is predicated on, what year are those studies from?
One of them covers the sales tax rebate checks from Minnesota, which were, 98, 99, 2000, is that right? Or were they 99, 2000, 2001? So one of them covers that. One of them covers the federal stimulus. You remember that we got kind of an advance payment on our tax refund or whatever in the early Bush years, and so they're back in that period. So this isn't a long time ago, and certainly things are different, but there was a weak economy there as well. Now, I can imagine, if it would have been me, you could have gotten more bounce for your buck by doing it on extended unemployment insurance, for example, that would have been sure to be spent. But the U.S. Senate, by insisting that seniors be covered, seniors with no income other than Social Security. You know, that, I think, ensured that more money was going to, a greater percentage of it was going to be spent as well.
Dr. Stinson, is there anything, I'm just assuming we're going to balance the budget, assuming that has no impact on the forecast, is there anything we could do in the process of balancing the budget that would create, what would be the most effective way for us to create some economic stimulus before we go home in May?
Mr. Chairman, it's very hard to create economic short-term economic stimulus because your tools are limited. You have limited resources. The federal government is devoting 1% of GDP to this stimulus package. In Minnesota, that would be $2.5 billion. And so given the budget resources that you have, you just don't have the ability to have the same kind of impact that the federal government does, since the federal government doesn't have to balance its budget. The place that seems to me the test that former Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers used for what is a good stimulus package is one that is timely, one that is temporary, and one that is targeted. And those are the three measures that you have to have. And so you have a lot of difficulty, it seems to me, meeting the timeliness thing. One possibility that seems to me to meet the test of both timeliness, being well targeted, and being temporary is to work through the capital budget. But here it's not to build things, but rather it is to devote capital budget resources to renovation and repair. Our belief is that the area of the economy that's going to be hit the hardest in the next 6 months is going to be the skilled trades people in the construction area. That those are people who the housing construction has pretty well dried up. They were able to find work in completing non-residential construction projects, hospitals, office buildings, things like that. That is pretty well dried up now, and these are people that are going to have a very difficult time over the next 6 to 9 months finding employment. If you can get a bill that has significant renovation and repair out so that it can be timely, that may have an effect. It meets the test of being timely, meets the test of being temporary because it is one-time renovation and repair that is generally needed, and it also is well targeted to a group that is going to be hit particularly hard. Now, the problem with all of this is that the way that you normally do capital budgets is that's pushed off and as part of this end of session flurry, and so if you don't get it done until the end of April or the middle of May, then by the time the projects are put out for bid, you know, you're in the middle of July or August, and you've lost the timeliness. And so the challenge for you is to figure out if there is some way that you can split that piece off and do that more quickly so that you get the activity out in the economy in April, May, June when it's going to be needed. And, of course, one of the advantages of this at this time is that there are people out there looking for work, and so you're going to get those bids more quickly, and you're going to probably get a better deal on the pricing as well.
So, Dr. Stinson, I'd be remiss if I didn't say if the legislature was going to provide some kind of a package to assist in the construction of an expansion at the Mall of America with non-general fund resources. Would we be wiser to do that early in the session or wait until May?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think my observation of the stimulus that came from the Mall of America is the original construction of the Mall of America is that for a long time there was this one guy driving a bulldozer around moving dirt, and then a little bit went on, and then all of a sudden, right at the end of the construction, right at the time that we actually needed the stimulus to the economy, because it just happened to be that the finishing work that was being done that required all the electricians and drywall people and painters and things like that, that all happened right at the time the economy needed that little extra boost in 2000 and was it 2001 or was it the 90? It was the 1991 recession. Is that right? Anyway, it was at the bottom of the recession. It was the 1991 recession. I don't think you can get enough stimulus soon enough at the Mall of America. I mean, the next thing you're going to have is for 3 months or 6 months, you're going to have somebody driving a bulldozer around, pushing dirt around. You're not going to have 500 people putting in electrical circuits or drywall or things like that. And so that doesn't meet the timely test for me.
Senator Limerick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Stinson.
I bet there'll be more than one bulldozer.
You didn't take the bait either, Senator Fogelman.
No, more than one bulldozer, I bet.
I think so. Senator Limerick.
Dr. Stinson, you talked about stimulus packages, and you made a reference that they had to be timely, targeted, and temporary. And some people liken our large sales tax increases, let's say for the recent one that just got involved in gas tax in order to hasten the construction of roads and bridges and transit needs. That I don't think is necessarily temporary. It may be targeted into a general construction. I don't know how it fits into the timely aspect of that, but is it appropriate for us to consider a gas tax like we just recently voted on? Is that something that you would equate to a stimulus package? Does it have the same effect or does it not?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limerick, to me a stimulus package is something that does something in the next 6 months. That's not going to have any impact in the next 6 months. This is something that's directed toward long-term growth prospects for the economy. And there are benefits that will come from improved infrastructure that will increase the productivity of Minnesota workers. And, that's the payoff from that. It's not something that's going to make a difference in somebody's employment in April or May.
Mm-hmm. One thing I've noticed is that for recent years we've had our bonding bills that sometimes have been debated on the floor of the Senate sold with the idea that they too are stimulus packages of sorts. But my recollection is that it takes about 2 years to get any impact of an economic benefit from it. Plus, we've also had bonding bills where we've maxed out our bonding authority every year for probably the past 10 or 14 years. And so we're just perpetuating whatever benefit there is, and we don't really see a new one because it's done all the time. So there really is no real net improvement to that stimulus benefit because we just perpetuate it all the time. I suppose if we didn't max out that bonding authority, then we would feel it the other way maybe 2 or 3 years later, but we certainly wouldn't be feeling it if we just continue to perpetuate the maxing out of that credit authority. So I'm not sure if necessarily that's the sales approach that one should have in being a proponent of bonding bills. It certainly benefits the local communities to get whatever they're building into a community, but but I don't know if it's necessarily an objective benefit. It's more, in many ways, subjective. People feel good about having a community center in their little town, or they, if we're saving a historic movie theater that once was debated years ago, everybody feels good about it, but does it really improve jobs? Does it really give the temporary improvement in jobs just for that construction phase? It's probably short-lived.
Senator Squay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as we're talking about the long-term and short-term effects of what we do here, what it looks to me like is we didn't pay enough attention 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago about the long-term needs of our economy, and now we're suffering the ramifications of that short-sightedness. Now, if we talk about the short-term stimulus of 6 months, and we see that in the third and the fourth quarter of this forecast, Dr. Stinson, my thought and my question to you is, you know, when we look at this housing credit crisis or problem that we have, it's apparent that people had too much debt, and as the interest rates started to rise, they couldn't afford to make payments on their home, and their values have fallen off, and the mortgages are foreclosed. But at the national level and across our country, I think our savings rate is at zero or might even be negative at some point. So we have this structural problem, and the Fed is lowering interest rates at their level, but it's not flowing through to the consumer. They have this huge debt load that the interest is not going down on. And don't we just have this kind of structural problem with credit and debt that even though we did a little federal short-term stimulus, it didn't solve anything? And how do we address that? And how do we take a little longer-term view of our economy so that we can have good long-term growth?
Mr. Chairman, that's the big question. I'd say, you know, the $64 billion question or something like that, except that really is too small a number to use in compared to the size of the question it is. We're in a very difficult situation right now. The market works, but there are a lot of problems with information. You hear people talking about transparency and things like that. And what they mean is that people don't really know what they're buying, and it's not just the individual home mortgager. With the individual home mortgage, big credit institutions didn't know what they were buying either, and big financial institutions that insured sophisticated financial instruments, packages of sophisticated financial instruments, didn't know what they were insuring, and we've gotten in a situation where the information has just been really bad, and it's going to take a while to work through. Increased saving by individuals, why would you save if interest rates are only 1%, something like that? There's not a whole lot of incentive to put off having something today because you want to build up a pile of money for the future. And why not borrow if interest rates are really low in there as well? As interest rates begin to move up, then you're going to get more savings because your return from savings is more. You're going to have less borrowing because it's more expensive to borrow ahead to buy that whatever it is that you want. It corrects, but that correction is very difficult, and that's something that the Fed is trying to smooth. Actually, you know, one might say Chairman Greenspan left Chairman Bernanke with a real difficult situation because he got us to this point where we had very little savings and very low interest rates, and now it's up to Chairman Bernanke to figure out a way to putting us on a path that gets us to the situation that you describe without creating undue economic dislocation. But, you know, if you look out for the next 5 years or 6 years or 7 years, it's going to be a real challenge. The one thing that we do have going for us is productivity, that people keep making things, more things faster and better. So we get that natural growth in there. But you know, your assessment is very good, that we are in a very difficult situation here.
Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Couple of points and then a question. I'm glad Senator Skoy brought up the subject of what were we doing 2-3+ years ago in terms of making those long-term investments that are available to us as policymakers. And that's an interesting question to ask and see if we can answer, because now we see Minnesota underperforming the country, and that's unique to our experience. I think maybe the transportation bill that we just passed, the answer to that question might be there might be a more immediate benefit than maybe meets the eye typically when we, you know, do a large infrastructure funding like that, because the simple fact is that there are a lot of projects in the queue, designed, ready to go, ready to bid, and construction companies that are able to mobilize and deploy workers and start getting those underway quickly. So I think it is conceivable. So I think it's up to the agency that they can get some things going in April, May, as you articulated, is important to do. My question is, the governor just issued the hiring freeze, and so I'm curious to know, how do we think about that? I mean, I know not all public spending is created equal, but just how do we think about the potential that, you know, in the near and reaching into the less near-term future, you know, conceivably 1,000 to 2,000 employees aren't going to be drawing a check. Granted, those are public resources. That's, you know, public expenditure. But nevertheless, they're, you know, I don't know if we've anticipated the closure of the Ford plant in some of these forecasts. I don't know if we're anticipating what might happen with Northwest Airlines Management Corps at their headquarters in Eagan or some others, but do we anticipate some effect from a shrinking state government employee payroll?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, in answer to your question, we did not include in the forecast any impact of state hiring freeze or anything like that. So that's not in the forecast. We did include expected closing of the Ford plant. We did include the Macy's layoffs.
Macy's.
We did not include anything from the Northwest, the rumored Northwest Delta merger in there. These are huge changes. All these are huge changes in the employment for a single firm, in the case of the state, but compared to the state's economy, they're not huge. That's not to minimize the effect on the individuals that are laid off. I mean, you know, that's just terrible for people. But 1,000 jobs, frankly, if we were within 1,000 jobs in our forecast overall, you know, we'd think we were successful. And so we're talking about 2.7 million jobs. 1,000 jobs is 2,700th of that. And so, you know.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I do remember in 2003, I mean, I think there was some discernible impact from the loss of a lot of public sector jobs.
I agree.
Up and down, you know, from local on up. But there was also some effect in our need to mobilize resources to deal with those displaced workers. So that has an effect on our spending side, too.
Mm-hmm. I agree. The 2003, there was a noticeable impact.
Senator Lemire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I'm kind of enjoying this conversation, but I think probably the thing that we come down to is that it's very difficult for government to respond to economic need and growth and trying to track it. Are we really the the perfect instrument to stimulate economy. I know Senator Skoyte concluded that perhaps 5 years ago government failed in anticipating crises that are out there in our economic world. I don't know if anyone could predict the crisis of the housing industry and how deep that would go. Maybe the higher price houses, I certainly, after 29 years of being in the business, thought that the prices on the top end of houses would begin to fall off, but I never thought that it would go as deep all the way down to the first starter home. And so that becomes very difficult for government or any other economist to try and anticipate. And then horizontally of how that crisis comes down from the high price down to the lowest price, and then horizontally go out and how it affects jobs and trades and craftsmen, that too becomes very difficult to predict. Whoever thought that, I do a little rehabbing and I hire craftsmen all the time. And right now, if I put a bid out to get some sheetrock guys to come out and sheetrock a house, I can get prices of quality guys that will be akin to maybe a price in the market maybe 20 years ago. They're hungry for any kind of work, and they're willing to compete for it in order to get that job. Now, how would government have anticipated that revenue stream? How would they have anticipated that tax revenue stream off that income? I don't know how anyone could have predicted it. So I think if we look at it realistically, government is a very poor immediate reactor to the economy. And the housing industry is just one of them. I think if my memory serves me correctly, housing industry in Minnesota accounts for anywhere from maybe 18 to 23% of all jobs, somewhere in that range. It's in that. Maybe I'm wrong, but it's a very significant part of our job market. And trying to anticipate it is going to be hard. Now, we try to do it, and I think Senator Skoyte probably picked up on a good signal that if we were relying on government to solve economic problems, yeah, we're not good at that. And I don't know if we ever will be. I've never known of an administration to predict economic crisis 5 years out and try and anticipate it. So, you know, Saudi Arabia could do what they're doing now and cut off production and limit it down, and that would impact the cost of fuel. And how would we have anticipated that 4 or 5 years ago? And what kind of job loss would that have occurred? I don't know how you do it.
No, Senator Limmer, I don't think it's quite fair to say that government can't participate or encourage economic growth. And we are, through our K-12 system and our higher ed system, really largely the workforce development sector. And we all get to see college students about every week. They come down here and they're concerned about tuition and they're concerned about the state grant program and the amount of debt they're going to carry when they conclude their education. My larger concern moving forward as it relates to workforce development is what are we doing to keep that as affordable as we can so as many people as they can get the skill set developed that they need, because I think if we don't make sure that we encourage them to get that and keep that affordable for them, they're not going to be ready for the workforce, and somebody's going to invest in them. If we haven't made it affordable for them, I would argue that the business community then is either going to take those jobs someplace else, or they're going to have to be willing to invest some money in those new hires to make sure that they have the skill set that they need to perform. So I do think in the area of workforce development, we can have some impact long term on the economy. We're going to determine whether, to a large degree, whether the employees are here with the skill set they need for the future economy. And I'm getting more and more concerned that, I think I saw that over the last 5 years, tuition at the University of Minnesota is up like about 60%. Well, I think if you look at the path we're on, at some point, there is going to be a tipping point where young people say, I'm not going to incur that kind of debt. I'm just not going to incur that kind of debt going into the job market and having to face, you know, moving my feet out from under mom and dad's table and getting a place of my own. At some point, I wonder, people just aren't going to do it. And then what impact does that have on the economy, on job growth, on the business community? Dr. Stinson, am I right to worry about workforce development and how it affects future job growth? Or because I'm concerned we're not investing enough there.
Mr. Chairman, State Demographer Tom Gillespie and I have been talking about this for more than a few years, and a couple of things that won't make you sleep any easier at night but may make you feel more confident about the position that you're taking. And one of them is that over the next decade, the number of people in the 18 to 24 age group, the college age population, actually shrinks both in Minnesota and nationally. And so if you're looking to recruit new workers for the workforce, it's going to be harder than in the past because that group isn't growing. That group's actually getting smaller. And it's the percentage that's decline in Minnesota is actually larger than it is nationally. So this group of 18 to 24s that you're trying to recruit to stay in Minnesota, to work in Minnesota, is going to be smaller and going to shrink more than the national group. It's going to happen in other states as well, obviously, and they're going to be trying to lure our 18 to 24-year-olds, the people that we've invested in the K-12 system, human capital for, to their states to work or to go to school. And we both would argue that it's going to be easier to recruit people for Minnesota businesses off the campuses in Minnesota than it is off the beaches in California. And so the tuition policy that we have, you know, suddenly begins to look like a tool for economic development in that it's a way of getting people both the skill sets that they need to be competitive in a global economy and increasing the number of people or not causing the number of people to decline as fast as it would otherwise by luring people from other states. And so it's both the resident tuition and the non-resident tuition probably issue as well. And we have to begin to think about, you know, how is it that we price tuition? Certainly there are enormous benefits for individuals for going to college or going to vocational technical schools that are captured by those individuals, and they should pay part of that cost. But then there's also a public benefit, a broader benefit by having a workforce available for the economy that meets the needs of the economy. And to this point, we haven't taken that into account probably as much as we'll need to in the future. When that cohort is growing, it's easy to ignore the issue. When the cohort starts to shrink, then the issue becomes more important.
Senator Pogelmeier.
Is the presentation over? Because I wanted to ask Commissioner a couple questions before he left.
No. Dr. Stinson? I think we're probably close, but why don't you tell us what the major reasons we're in the situation we're in are.
Major reasons we're in the situation we're in is, one, housing. There's a graph on the top of page 13, I think, maybe it's either page 13 or page 11 that shows what's happened to the housing outlook. It's the graph right before the capital gains graph. What you can see there, I can tell you real quickly. In 2005, single-family housing starts fourth quarter in Minnesota, 2,400 per month. In 2006, a fourth quarter single-family housing starts 1,200 a month. In 2007, fourth quarter, 800 a month. A 50% drop, and then a one-third drop on top of that. You know, this is this is just a disaster for the construction industry and the wood products industry. Construction industry, as I indicated, we think we're going to lose 13,000 jobs this year in that area. A lot of this is going to be people in the skilled trades. That's why I was making this point about the repair and renovation activity might be a good way of stopping some of this. On the lumber and wood products area, we think we're going to see a decline of 2,200 jobs on top of already a 2,500 job decline that we've seen over the last 2 years.
Mr. Chairman?
Could I
just ask, repair and renovation is better because it can happen faster than new construction? That's the point?
That's the point. If you're going to hit these people that are going to lose, that are not going to be, well, Senator Limmer's group that are out there looking for work right now, you know, yes, you can help them a year from now or 15 months from now with a new building, but repair and renovation, these are people that are going to be able to help right now.
But if a, Mr. Chairman, but if a new building is ready to go, they've done everything and they're ready to go, it's the same thing.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogemiller, you know, have you ever built a house? You know, it takes a while to get to the point where you're making use of all the skilled trades people.
I see. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Dr. Stinson, continue.
Okay. Second problem is that the housing situation has exposed a problem with the credit industry, and the credit industry, we now have a situation where the Federal Reserve is trying to lower interest rates. Interest rates are low, but nobody is loaning money, even though interest rates are low, because nobody trusts anybody's credit worthiness at this point. Credit is really the fuel that the economy runs on, business credit in particular, and that's gone. That fuel is largely drying up, and so until we get that taken care of, that's going to hold the economy back in there. It's going to hold the economy back by slowing or bringing to a halt, largely a halt, non-residential construction. The recent senior loan officer survey from the Federal Reserve said that 82% of all banks had tightened their standards for commercial industrial real estate loans. That means it's harder to get credit. You're going to have to pay higher interest rates in there. I've said before, you know, if you hear the words AMBAC and MBIC, you should pay attention because those insurers who insured state and local government obligations largely branched off, insured all kinds of exotic financial instruments to the extent that their credit ratings are dropped. Those instruments that they insured, the credit ratings of those instruments they insured will drop, and then all those prices will have of those credit instruments will be repriced, and so, you know, we'll be back in the same problems that we were in last August when this first became most visibly apparent. So those are the two things. And then, as I've said before, there's the energy price issue. The energy price issue by itself isn't going to bring the economy down, but given the problems with other things, it could contribute to an even weaker economy than we had before.
Dr. Stinson, I think I read or heard in the last couple of days that because of the credit situation and the housing slump, that housing and the recession, that housing prices could correct up to 20%. Could it really, I mean, could people's equity actually erode by as much as 20%?
Mr. Chairman, Mark Zandi, who's the head of economy, Moody'sEconomy.com, says the following. If we have 900,000 new homes built in 2008, and if we have 900,000 new homes built, only 900,000 new homes built in 2008, that's the lowest housing construction number since World War II. So he's not saying assume that we have a lot of houses built. He's saying assume that we don't have hardly any houses built compared to what we would normally have, the lowest amount since World War II. If there's no growth in employment over the year, which is consistent with a recession scenario and consistent with his recession scenario, then in order to get through the housing problem, to get inventories back to normal levels, we would have to have a 20% decline in housing prices this year. Now, that's kind of the challenge. We've got to get through this housing price excess or housing excess inventory in housing in order to get the housing industry back on track again. In order to do that this year, that means a 20% decline. I don't think that that's likely to occur. And so that means that this housing problem is going to extend out for more than a year that leaves you not particularly optimistic looking on out.
That's helpful. Dr. Stinson, anything further?
No, I think I've brought enough cheer and
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogelmaner.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, just two questions I wanted to ask. And I do appreciate in the document, it's been pointed out several times that if you incorporate inflation into the estimates, the number is $2 billion. Let me just ask you a very direct technical question. If we pass the language that has been floating around for a couple of years, does that in any way put spending on autopilot? The language that was in the tax bill, that all it said was, you gotta incorporate inflation in this document. Does that in any way, and this is a purely technical question, because if I don't think you've answered it correctly, I'm gonna ask somebody else. Does that in any way put spending on autopilot?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogelmaner, I didn't think I'd get out of here without talking about inflation with you. I think that when we calculated inflation, and we're aware of what that number is, it's not technically rolled into the forecast because we are forbidden by statute. But I think what happens is, and you think back to the Carlson years, that when you factor inflation in, everybody assumes that, you know, that's the base, and then, you know, the public debate, it's more of a public debate issue. Then what, you know, what's the starting point?
Does it technically ignite, does it in any way as a finance commissioner force you to spend any money?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogelmaner, from a technical point, when we get the November forecast before a biennial budget, that advises us of how much revenue, you know, either revenue and expenditures, and then we have the choice of whether to add that or not.
Correct. So does it in any way, without actions by the legislature and a signature by the governor, create automatic pilot spending?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogelmaner, the only no.
Thank you. So is there concern, let me just ask, and this is a trick question, so you may want not to answer it. Are you concerned that the governor will be unable to withstand? Is it a question of weakness? Or because I'm under the impression that the governor absolutely does not want to build a budget based on inflation. what's the problem? I mean, is there a concern that he will not be able to prepare a budget if we simply add inflation in this document that doesn't include inflation? Because he absolutely has the authority not to include it. And he absolutely has the authority not to sign a bill that the legislature sends him that puts inflation on spending. So what is the concern, since it doesn't force autopilot spending?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogelmaner, we're starting to get into what our supplemental budget will look like.
I'll hold on that one then, okay?
Well, I'm sure we'll see each other elsewhere.
Okay. And then just one other point. I was noticing...
Senator Pogelmaner, this is your third question now, and you said you had a couple.
No, the first one was about inflation.
Yeah.
Page 24 of this document. says that widespread job declines and that Minnesota's got a narrow base of job creation now, and that year to year, all the sectors basically are having negative impacts on jobs, except for private education and health services industries. Health services industries, there were 14,900 jobs created. So if the governor's budget suggests cuts in health care, isn't there a danger that we will now eliminate jobs in the health care industry and eliminate one of the bright spots in job creation?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogermiller, I don't know enough about where those specific jobs are, whether our budget cuts, if we do have Health and Human Services budget cuts. I don't know the answer to that at this point.
But we should, it seems to me, Mr. Chairman, we should watch for that, because if that's the one bright spot of job creation, or one of the two bright spots of job creation, I think we'd want to be careful not to cut spending in a way that cost us jobs.
But that also, Senator Pogermiller, is the fastest growing area in our budget as well. So it has a double-edged sword. It's good that people have jobs, but you know, it also is absorbing, as we all know, and as you have heard Dr. Stinson and Tom Gillespie talk about our aging population and the increase in our and the increases that will apply to our services. Yes, it makes more jobs, but are they the kind of jobs we want? I mean,
but Commissioner,
is it better to have the jobs elsewhere?
But if we have an aging population, isn't it obvious that there'll be more people in the healthcare industry?
That's why
I think this discussion of the exploding costs in healthcare is really a demographic issue, not so much as prolific at spending. Matter of fact, everything we hear, at least I don't know about others, but what I hear is that we have shortages of people in the healthcare industry to provide quality services. The nurses are telling us that. The nursing home workers are telling us that. And so I think we need, it may not be a job that you and I are participating in, but a job that pays a wage is better than someone not having a job. I think we just need to be a little concerned that if we're going to, we need to be vigilant that if we do make health care spending cuts, which the governor mentioned yesterday, that it doesn't impact the one area, one of the two areas that we're actually growing jobs. So that was my only point, Mr. Chair.
You know, a debate for another day, but as we grow in our, the 15 to 20% increases in human services, so I mean, the natural consequence of what you're saying is that if you don't believe we should reduce, control that spending in human services, because I think that directly ties into the people who work there.
I don't think we should control, Commissioner, I don't think we should, it may not be an issue of improper spending or not legitimate spending, which is kind of the tone of we have to control the spending. It may be that because of demographics, we need more people in that area to provide the kind of services that Minnesotans need. And I think if you put that context on it, then maybe what's going on in the healthcare area isn't as bad as some would like to portray it. Is the only, we need to examine it. We need to get cost containment. If it's not well invested dollars, absolutely. Waste and inefficiency in the executive branch, absolutely. But boy, we got to be careful not to choke off one of the job growth areas.
Well, Senator Pogermiller, I think also what's going on in addition to the demographics likely is changes in medical technology is creating a lot of procedures that we probably weren't doing just a few years ago, which is creating some new jobs out there, I imagine. Also,
Medtronic thinks, I think, that jobs in their company are probably good jobs.
Thank you. Mr. Showalter, on the spending side, anything?
Sure. Mr. Chair, going back to the presentation, you'll see a brief slide. Just for your information, there are some small changes in the spending estimates associated with the February forecast. Amongst those is an increase in health and human services that we were just talking about $74 million. Roughly $33 million of that was associated with an appropriation that was set aside from last session. When federal rules were promulgated, there was an impact, and based upon language in the bill that was enacted last year, that money was released from the reserve. That is probably a place where we have some additional spending risk going into the future. There have been stories in the national press about how the federal government may be shifting costs from the federal government to the state government. So as a result, that could experience some additional medical assistance cost pressures or cost shifts from the federal government. Otherwise, there's very little changes here on the spending side. Would also like to note that the revenue estimates that Dr. Stinson has talked about do affect the estimates of the debt service calculation. One of our financial principles has been the 3% limit of debt service compared with non-dedicated general fund revenues. As we have fewer general fund revenues, we have less of capacity to handle the debt service that's associated with that. Based on the forecast before you, that figure moves from $965 million to $885 million. The last slide here on page, on the last page, is just looking at the 2010 and 11 projections. As mentioned earlier in the presentation, those figures carry out estimates of revenues and spending so that you get a long-term look at the state's financial position and the structural questions that we have to all look at. The difference between the revenues and spending during that biennium is $1,086,000,000. That is not including the inflation that was also discussed previously. That, I believe, Mr. Chair, concludes the presentation.
Senator Pogomon.
Is it fair to characterize the $64 million, over half of that, a little over half of that, is that contingency reserve account? So it's really, we really don't have, on the spending side, it's pretty, we were right on. I mean, the estimates were pretty close, right on.
Mr. Chair, Senator, absolutely.
That was because of a federal cut. That was
small changes in spending estimates, and indeed, not even all of that 64 hits the bottom line, since we had $33 million sitting in the reserve.
Right, and that was because of federal cuts, that $33 million.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes. It was basically the decision last session to try and provide some funds for counties to cover some of the costs, not necessarily all of the costs, but some of the costs that were borne by counties associated with federal changes.
And that, Mr. Chairman, Portland. And that's one-time money, so now the counties are still confronted with this problem because we just gave them some one-time money to take care of the federal cuts.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes.
Thank you.
Anything else, members? Panel, anything else?
Well, that's it.
Thank you for coming in on a Friday morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Everybody have a good weekend. And members, thank you for hanging in there. I believe we're going to meet on Tuesday, and we've got some members' bills. Oh, we've got the department policy bill, and we're going to go through the tax expenditure report. Committee adjourned until Tuesday.